Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 20th of August. This hour, observations on all that is going on in Ferguson, Missouri and beyond through the thoughts of Milwaukee's top law enforcement official. The killing of an unarmed 18-year-old African-American, the subsequent protests that have continued for 10 days, the response to those protests, the strained relationship in that community between the police department and the mostly African-American community, the civil rights investigation, the arrival of Attorney General Eric Holder, who has said some very interesting things about what he would like to see accomplished in Ferguson. There are also 40 FBI agents in that town. Holder says they'll work with police, civil rights leaders, and members of the public to ensure that this tragedy can give rise to a new understanding and robust action aimed at bridging persistent gaps between law enforcement officials and the communities we serve. Our guest this hour is Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn. I told him as he walked in, I can't believe he's been here this long, and I haven't interviewed him yet, so we're making up for that today. He's been leading the department since 2008. He has long-time and wide-ranging police experience, police commissioner in Springfield, Massachusetts, secretary of public safety under Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney, chief of police in Arlington, Virginia, where he worked on the recovery effort at the Pentagon after the September 11 terrorist attack. He began his career in the Jersey City Police Department and has a number of national associations. He's a member of the Police Executive Research Forum, serves on the executive committee of the International Association of Chiefs of Police, Harvard Kennedy School's executive session on policing. We'll be welcoming phone calls as we carry on. We're going to talk for a while, and then we will get to your phone calls. Keep the number in mind. It's 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. You can also find us on Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, should you care to use that. That is at K Dunn Show. Chief Flynn, thanks very much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Yeah, nice to have you on the air. You were quoted as saying that the Milwaukee Police Department is taking notes and listening to what's going on in Ferguson, and you talked about being disturbed by the level of breakdown that's taking place. What kinds of notes are you taking? What are you hearing?
Well, you know, the entire profession is obviously watching the events unfold in Ferguson. There really hasn't been this level of disturbance in an American community in quite some period of time. It's reminiscent really of decades ago rather than of current events. And so we're watching, you know, how this has unfolded. We're watching how the local authorities responded initially, how they've responded subsequently, how they've handled public communications, and how they've handled the investigation. And I think there's certainly a growing consensus in American law enforcement that there have certainly been some highly visible missteps that have perhaps exacerbated whatever problems predated the critical incident.
You hear so many reporters from Ferguson, and we had a young African-American journalist on last week who grew up in Ferguson and talked about he had been pulled over at least 50 times, once for having snow on his license plate, even though it was snowing outside, and that that was not an unusual occurrence. We hear from so many people who say that they've just not had very good relationship at all with the police force in Ferguson. Plus, you've got poverty, plus you've got segregation at play here, and it's been described as a powder keg that really was just waiting to happen. Were there some lessons that should have been learned a long time ago about how police deal with the community? Are there things you do as chief here to teach officers that?
Well, I think, first of all, it'll take quite some time to understand what the situation was in Ferguson in reality before this incident occurred. And obviously that will come out once this has really been analyzed. And obviously as this winds down in terms of the activity in the street, there'll be time for thoughtful analysis. I think what I can say generally is there certainly are an awful lot of American cities out there with significant disadvantaged populations mm-hmm. that aren't powder kegs. But we can't discount the fact that there's an extraordinary amount of frustration in these communities. You know, we've done some many levels of analysis in the police department trying to come to grips with the nature of the problem we deal with here in Milwaukee, and a number of progressive city agencies do similar things. And one of the things we undertook to do was to take an examination of, you know, we can obviously see with the density map where we engage in the most proactive police activity. And as you would expect, if we drew an ellipse over that and traced where the most violent crime was, it would be the same location. But we decided to expand that notion further, and we said, all right, let's create ellipses that show where's the greatest population density. Okay. Where's the greatest amount of poverty in Milwaukee? There's the ellipse. Where's the greatest concentration of African-American residents in Milwaukee? Draw that ellipse. Where's the lowest rate of educational attainment and high school dropouts? Drew that ellipse. Drew the ellipse for the highest rate of unemployment. You draw all those ellipses, and I can, you know, show you the maps, all right? They perfectly overlay where the police are most heavily engaged. Mm-hmm. Now, here's what we recognize. The police have engagements with the community across an extraordinary array of issues, all right? 80% of the time in the busiest, most crime-ridden cities, we're doing social work. We're engaging in family violence issues, substance abuse issues, mental health issues, a variety of disturbances, substandard housing issues. By the way, the foreclosure ellipse is the same as the high crime ellipse. The fire department response ellipse is the same as the crime ellipse. Point is, there's a lot of things going wrong in these communities. Crime is the most visible and egregious symbol of it. And most of the crime, if you looked at disparities in Milwaukee or any central city, greatest disparity is the number of African-American victims of violent crime. When you add all this together, the police are the representatives of all government. But we're not all government. We don't control all of the variables in these communities. And when you've got literally dozens, if not hundreds, of young African-American men without jobs on a hot summer night, frustrated by an incident that appears to be unjust based on what they know about it, coupled with everything else that's going on out there.
Coupled with guns.
I'm sure it's more than a couple, mm-hmm. The fact of the matter is you do have a recipe for problems, and then it's the police department has to think very carefully how to respond to that ignition. And that's where you can make some really big mistakes if you come on too heavy, too fast, and set yourselves up. If I may, as the focal point of the demonstrations, rather than allowing legitimate demonstrations to take place while holding open the option of responding to violence.
Yeah. Would you describe the relationship that most police officers have with those high crime areas as one in which people in the community feel that the police is there to protect them, that they will call when there's something happening, or do you sense still some antagonism and work that needs to be done in that area?
I'd say it depends. And here's one of the great fallacies people fall into when they come from outside to examine social circumstances in any city. And that is, they keep saying the community, as though unique among Americans, the African-American community is monolithic. All right, that everybody thinks the same thing, feels the same way. There is certainly a bifurcation of opinion in that community, just like there is in the European American community, left versus right, conventional attitudes towards unconventional attitudes, employed people and unemployed people. What I'll tell you is if you go to a neighborhood meeting, which our people do all the time, what you hear is folks complaining about crime, about fear, about disorder, and about young people. Police, please do something. If you're on a corner with a number of young men who may be limited in economic opportunity and may or may not have criminal records, the police are not seen as necessarily their friends. And yet the people behind the padlocks drive through a neighborhood and look at all the bars on the windows where the people live who are afraid of crime. Mm-hmm. Okay? They're fortified. All right? I remember once going to a scene of a quadruple homicide in this town, and I felt like I was at a vampire movie because it was dark when I got there. Streets were deserted. When the sun came up, people came out from houses with bars on the doors and windows to mow their lawns and let their kids play in the backyard. And when sun went down, they went inside. This was the summertime. They went inside because they were afraid because of the people that would take advantage of them. So there are different opinions out there. The challenge for the police, obviously, is recognizing where we're wanted and needed the most, that we have this very delicate balance, mm-hmm. both in Milwaukee and in urban policing generally, which is there is a history that has not always been a positive one, but between police activities in high-crime central city areas populated by minority groups. Okay? Haven't been. All right, we've still got the memories of the 60s films in our heads and the 70s riots. It's in our heads. It's part of our social historical narrative. And if I may go back into history, there's a reason why they call prison vans paddy wagons. All right. There was a day when those were my people in the back of that truck, and they were the poor and the dispossessed and the violent and the angry and the drunk and so on. Mm-hmm. So it's a motif of American history, but it's been particularly pernicious in these last, 50 or 60 years in the African-American community. And so the challenge for us is, do we learn from our history or are we held hostage to it? Is every time there's a critical incident mean there's been no progress made? Now, I think by any objective standard, there's been extraordinary progress in the professionalism of the police agencies in this country, their diversity, generally speaking, their levels of training, their levels of integrity. There's been extraordinary declines in the use of force by police agencies generally and here in Milwaukee, extraordinary declines in the use of deadly violence. But nonetheless, we recognize that we have to police the communities that need us in a way that allays their suspicions. And conventional police tactics, however well-meaning, can be perceived as alienating and frightening if they're not explained, contextualized, and supported by the community. Very conventional police activities, car stops, okay? They can be extraordinarily fraught in some communities unless the groundwork has been laid for what you're trying to do and what you're responding to. You can't impose crime control on a neighborhood. You have to work with that neighborhood and know that there's support for what you're trying to do. Because going back to first cases, the disparate victimization of disadvantaged neighborhoods, frequently of color, is extraordinary. All right? We know the propensity to sin is equally distributed across all races, ethnic, and socioeconomic groups. We know that. But public space violent crime has historically been the province of the poor. And it is those behaviors that significantly disadvantage neighborhoods and make them unreceptive to economic development, that drive out jobs, that drive out merchants, and that drive out economic opportunity. So there's a number of layers here why it's important to change the narrative of these neighborhoods and to affect the crime rate. And so, the advancements of American policing through the community policing era, which was essential, and I hope we can get into what happened to us after 9/11, are important discussions to be reminded of as we contextualize what we're trying to do now.
So today, Eric Holder, the Attorney General, arrived in Ferguson. There's been a lot of talk about how the president should respond, how the Attorney General should respond. The New York Times had an interesting front page piece today about their two styles and the fact that the civil rights movement has informed Eric Holder's decision to go to Ferguson. He wanted to go even earlier to bring FBI agents and to broaden the whole investigation. So we're looking at issues of civil rights and whether or not they've been violated in Ferguson. The question has been hanging over this whole 10-day period of this disparity between the makeup of the community and the makeup of the police force. Eric Holder, as an African-American man who lived through in the South and lived through some horrendous experiences, would appear to be more welcome in that community to investigate what happened simply because of the color of his skin and his past. Does it make sense? And do we in Milwaukee have African-American officers and minority officers in predominantly minority areas, or have we moved beyond that?
Well, there's a couple of things to keep in mind here. Eric Holder's dad was a cop. Mm-hmm. He was a New York City cop. And so he comes from a background of integrating law enforcement as well, which was an essential development in the professionalism of policing and its ability to respond effectively to various communities. But it is an extraordinary challenge for us right now. There was a period of time where we really and continue to do work very hard to recruit and to alter testing processes so as to make sure that we are not inadvertently discriminating against anybody. That's something that's common to every big city I know, particularly. They're desperate for African-American recruits. But here's our challenge. The same places where we're trying to recruit young men for law enforcement are the same places where we are turning ourselves inside out trying to do something about the extraordinary dropout rates in the local schools and the substandard educational products they're producing. At the end of the day, we still have to have people who are capable of writing a report and are capable of doing what's really a complex social role. And it's not that they're not out there in the African-American community. It's that we need help accessing those folks because, sadly, when there are critical incidents, there is so much negativity about the police from official African-American leaders that I say to myself, why would you know, a college graduate, sociology major, African-American man or woman join the police department when all they hear from their leaders is, look how terrible the police are. Now, you know, I came out of the 60s. I graduated college in 1970. The world was full of presidential reports on problems in the cities, problems in the criminal justice system, problems in violence, problems with the riots in the cities, the problems with the Chicago riot. And the notion was, okay, if you're going to change, you have to change from within. You can demonstrate all you want. Institutions change when critical masses of individuals perceive that institution differently from within. Now, there's a generation of police leaders that are getting a little long in the tooth, and I'm one of them, that dedicated themselves to institutionalizing community-based policing. And we had the assistance of the Justice Department to do it, and we recognized that good, hard-nosed policing was necessary but had to be embedded in community support and approval. And that notion goes back to Robert Peel in 1829 in London, okay? You have to support with the consent of a democratic people. And we made progress in those events. But there has been slippage in recruitment. Latino recruitment is up. Asian recruitment is up. African-American recruitment, ironically, is going the opposite way after a number of years of improvements. So we need help from the from role models and from political officials. Yes, by all means, maintain your right to complain about the status quo, but urge people to pick up this challenge, because there's no more socially important role in society generally and disadvantaged communities particularly than high-quality law enforcement. We believe we're delivering that here, but we also recognize that having more officers of color could only be an advantage. But I will also add one other thing. When it comes to assignments, we keep in mind that our people are human beings, and whether they're African-American, white, or Hispanic, we don't automatically send them to neighborhoods that look like them for the following reason. Those tend to be the busiest, hardest places to work. And every copper who's willing to do hard work is willing to do it, but also wants a chance to go to one of the, quote, country club districts for a little while and not have to face the burnout. So, yeah. Our African-American officers are treated like everybody else. Yes, they help us out enormously in those disadvantaged neighborhoods, but they get to take a step away from the burnout, too. And we've got to be very sensitive to that.
Yeah. What did you make of, because our heads are all filled with the images of Ferguson, what did you make of the conduct of Officer Johnson, who took over, who went to the church, who expressed apologies to the people because he was wearing a different uniform, but saying that he was sorry, he's going to be out there marching with them, at least for a night. It calmed everything down. Do you do training? What kind of training? And he was warmly received. Mm-hmm. Is that a model for how to deal with a tense situation like that, or was it overboard?
Well, no, not at all. I mean, he was assuming a leadership role. But he's not embedded in the community because the state patrol don't patrol that community. So what he was doing is exercising leadership in a broader context.
Right.
When it comes to day-to-day policing, your coppers have got to be out in the neighborhood. We've got more foot patrols than we've ever had since olden days here. We do a lot of bicycle patrols. We do enormous array of community partnerships with embedded neighborhood institutions. We spend time. We were the only city in the country that achieved two specific federal grants, a Byrne Criminal Justice Innovation Grant from the Justice Department and a grant from the White House, the Building Neighborhood Capacity Grant. Both of them are founded on the notion that police have to help develop, it's a form of nation building, indigenous leadership in our most disadvantaged neighborhoods. Because where there is the highest crime, there are the highest number of scary bad people who control the street life of that neighborhood. And the folks that are otherwise known as victims are often atomized and cut off from each other because of fear. And so the challenge for the police are, how can we get into that neighborhood, identify those people, and organize them for advocacy for their own neighborhood? And so we're investing a lot of resources in doing that. We want to get in there and get the violence down, but then we don't want to leave a vacuum. We want to try to help neighborhoods get to their feet so they can take control of their streets, because informal social control is essential. The police cannot impose safety on everyone. We not only have to have community cooperation, our goal is to build neighborhoods that can sustain civic life. That's the goal. Democracy cannot function when people are afraid to use their public spaces. And that's what's happened in too many of our neighborhoods in this country. And that's very much what the community policing movement's been dedicated to deal with.
Milwaukee Police Chief Edward Flynn is our guest this hour. We asked him to come in the wake of all that's been going on in Ferguson because it raises so many questions about police relationship with the community. We'll talk about militarization of police forces and if that's happened and how that may have happened, what is an appropriate response to what's been going on there, and all of the issues. I mean, there are so many of them that have been exposed because of what happened in Ferguson. And we also have all of our phone lines filled, and they have been for about a half hour. So we will go to you right away. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. We have emails coming in as well. To you momentarily on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn is our guest. We are loaded with response. Let's go to Keith first in Madison. Hi, Keith.
Oh, hi. Yes, for Johnson to come in and try to mollify the people of Ferguson with a lot of sweet words was, I think, was rather insulting to the people of Ferguson. I think they're more politically astute than that. And I can give you some examples of what I'm talking about. After the police in Ferguson released a video of the of Michael Brown allegedly robbing a store, the people of Ferguson went on a smash and grab sale, and they were aided by the police in Ferguson, and they targeted that store because the store had collaborated with the police, and they know that when they poison the atmosphere by trying to help validate in the minds of many white people the violent proclivities of black people, it taints any jury pool. And they had a right to be outraged. And I think what the chief should do is give a full-throated condemnation of the Ferguson police. And don't tell me that the media asked for the video. They didn't ask for the video. They didn't even have to know about the video. They told them about the video, and then they released the video.
All right, Keith, thanks for the call. What do you think about the release of the video?
Well, that's always a challenge for any police agency when you're in the midst of a crisis, how much information to release. It's very difficult. You want to try to provide as much context for whatever happened as possible, as rapidly as possible. But at the same time, you've got, and this happens everywhere, I'm not just talking about here, certainly, you've got a district attorney's office that's very worried about a prosecution, and therefore they'll say, well, don't say this, don't say that, don't let this out. You'll have your civil attorneys in the city side saying, oh, for God's sakes, don't talk about this, don't talk about that. You'll increase our liability exposure. And then you've got an angry community that wants to know what's going on. If you say nothing, then whatever is said at the scene by random people becomes the fact. Now, if I've learned one thing in police work over the years, it's this. First, reports are always wrong. Always wrong. But they get around the world five times before you get a fact out. Now, the first reports that dominated the news media for 3 or 4 days was he was shot in the back running away with his hands up. Autopsy report comes out a week and a half later or a week later. He was shot in the front. What that means, we don't know. We know he wasn't shot in the back running away, okay? Now, when it comes to releasing the video, all right, what's the goal here? Well, one side's going to say, well, you're demonizing and libeling the dead. The other side's going to say, all right, if we have a video almost contemporaneous with the shooting that shows this young man engaged in violent behavior, is it plausible there was violent behavior being engaged in when the officer confronted him? Is that a reasonable thing to attempt to communicate? It's a judgment call. I can certainly say if there had been a random video of the police officer pushing and shoving a random citizen moments before this, it would be national news. We'd all say, well, of course we should know that. Shows the cop is brutal. So it's not an easy call. All right. You're going to be wrong whatever you do. The challenge is, how do you fill the information vacuum in a way that doesn't compromise investigations, that doesn't compromise prosecutions, but tells the truth rapidly enough to refute wild rumors that are frequently entirely wrong, but nonetheless frightening, scary, and inflammatory. And that's an ongoing challenge everywhere.
Well, what kind of training? It's hard for me to imagine what it's like to be a police officer, and we count on them, and it's, I can only imagine how difficult a job it is. But there are all these decisions that have to be made, life and death decisions, and I'm wondering what kind of training takes place, because as you know, we've heard they shot Michael Brown, an unarmed 18-year-old. Mm-hmm. How do you train yourself so you know how, what the appropriate response is when shooting is a response? How careful do you have to be about shooting somebody who's unarmed? How do you tell?
Well, it is, you are right. It is very, very difficult. Now, when I came on the job, there was eight weeks of training. That was considered a lot for police, okay? Today, it's 6 months. And there's an extraordinary amount of time spent on firearms tactics and also shoot, don't shoot. Mm-hmm. They go through hours of, mm-hmm. you know, hold your fire twice, assess, mm-hmm. back up. You know, the enormous amounts of time are spent on less lethal options, understanding that even, you know, supposedly less lethal uses of force can have a tragic outcome. One thing we know is that a lawful use of force is just as ugly looking as an unlawful use of force. And what we've, you know, learned by examining homicides of police officers. You know, a man with a knife can kill a man with a gun if he moves fast enough. You know, an unarmed individual, and I'm not speaking at all about Ferguson because I have no idea what happened there globally. Unarmed individuals that are stronger than you than trying to get your gun present a deadly threat to you. What do you do? All right. There are physical moves you're taught, but if this person is outweighs you by 50 pounds, is stronger than you are, you know, motivated by adrenaline or fear or what have you, and you're losing control of the firearm, you have a right to use deadly force. Okay. You know, there is stress in that decision. I mean, every officer in a critical incident knows that they are engaging in the most scrutinized act of government. All right? They know that. They're not only is their life in their hands at that moment, their life is in their hands while numerous levels of investigation take place and people call for their, you know, resignation, firing, imprisonment, jailing, what have you, before any facts are out. And so that places a big burden on officers in these circumstances. You know, there are many reasons why uses of force are dramatically down, and the main one is training. But, you know, as rare as it is, and I think, you know, someone did some research, I think, you know, back in 2012, I think there was something on the order of several million. What was it? I haven't got the data point here, but there was like something on the order of like, you know, millions of arrests in the United States and 400 uses of deadly force by the police nationally. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's an extraordinarily rare event. But the fact is, it was 2012, there were 12,197,000 arrests in the United States.
Woo.
Okay? And there were 410 uses of deadly force.
Hmm.
Now, that is, I think, 0.003%, 0.003 of a percent. All right? So it's still an extraordinarily rare event, an extraordinarily scrutinized event, and one for which as much training as we do, we cannot prepare people for every conceivable eventuality.
Should cameras be worn?
Well, you know, we started with the cameras in the vehicles. The industry is gradually adopting cameras on officers. Well, we did a small pilot project some time ago. We've put a request for proposals out on the street to purchase 50 more. One of the things you have to understand in government, buying technology takes time, and by the time you have it, it's obsolete. All right, so we're going to try to do this gradually because we expect the technology will be evolving even as we're buying it. So we're going to put 50 on the street fairly soon once the RFP is done. You know, we'll build our
what's done RFP,
the request for proposals.
Okay.
You know, have to go through the bidding process.
Okay.
And you know, take the lowest bid. You know, and we'll put those out on the streets in a broader project. And then what we'll gradually do is expand that as we move forward. So you know, it's an issue once again. You know, be careful what you wish for because the next issue is going to be privacy. Wait a minute, I called the police to my family to handle a dispute. Why do I have to be recorded? You know, so we have to have policies and procedures for that as well. But it's certainly the direction the profession's going.
Rick in Milwaukee. Hi.
Oh, hello, Kathleen.
Hi, Rick.
And to your guest. Back in the 1990s, I used to go to an African-American bar in the city of Milwaukee. And I met a young man there who called himself Rambo. He said bro because he was a brother. So instead of Rambo, it was Rambo. He said he handled a rifle on the City of Milwaukee Police Department Tactical Squad. And what he proceeded to tell me is that this government of the City of Milwaukee is so rotten toward African Americans that every now and then one of them just goes berserk and starts shooting up the neighborhood. Then he'd get the call, and he'd go there with his rifle, and when he could take a good shot, he would kill the guy. And then he said he would limit the damage done to the neighborhood. Now, he said he'd done that for 20 years. So I was wondering if the City of Milwaukee is still pretty much handling situations in that manner.
Yeah, I've never heard of that. No, it's no.
Sarah in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Thank you. Chief Flynn, I was wondering why the United States Police Force is allowed to use tear gas when tear gas is banned for use in warfare as a chemical weapon according to the Geneva Convention. So we can't use tear gas in war, but we can use it against our own American citizens. If you could explain that, please.
Well, you know, that's the decision as to its legality for law enforcement has been ruled on by authorities other than me. I can tell you that the majority of chiefs that I know, and I am among them, don't want to employ it because more often than not, it makes things worse. But it is certainly useful in barricaded subject circumstances. If you've got somebody with a semi-automatic assault-grade rifle, tear gas is a better way to get them to surrender than storming the place and killing them. So it very much has a place in law enforcement. We have tear gas and the military has napalm. We don't want to use napalm. They've got weapons we're not going to ever use. But the use of tear gas has its uses in police work. I've never been a fan of it for crowd control. It drifts to places you can't predict. It ends up gassing people that you don't want to affect. And I think often it just inflames the circumstance. So, you know, as I've looked at the crowd control tactics used in Ferguson, and keep in mind, this isn't just Ferguson. You can tell by the array of uniforms there, this is some sort of mutual aid, law enforcement council where they've cobbled together a civil disturbance unit for a couple dozen agencies. And you can tell they're not well organized. They're not well disciplined. They set themselves up to stand there and get stuff thrown at them, and then they run after people. I mean, you know, certainly it's not the way I've ever handled a dispute or civil disturbance. And my colleagues that I respect certainly don't do it that well either. So it's not been an example of law enforcement handling both protests and civil disturbances with the level of restraint and professionalism that I'm used to dealing with. So the short answer to your question is tear gas has a role in law enforcement, particularly in tactical situations. But I think it's a bad move in crowd control, and very few agencies use it for that.
So what's the story with? We've been hearing all these reports that we had all this surplus from the Pentagon. So they decided to give it to police forces in terms of armored tanks and camouflage uniforms and gas masks, and that they are being used with increasing frequency among police departments in this country, left over from the war on drugs and the war on terrorism. Is that true? Are there a lot of these? Is it overkill?
Well, first of all, there's enormous amounts of oversimplification, and that's just the nature of the communications world we live in. Okay, there's no complicated issue for which there isn't a simple explanation that's usually wrong. When it comes to what law enforcement is dealing with right now, keep in mind the following. We made enormous progress in the 90s. Dealing with crime, both from an organizational and accountability way, but also in terms of the embracing and the distribution of community place strategies. Okay, the notion of working with neighborhoods, developing neighborhoods, being place-based, having steady assignments of officers, engaging in problem-solving activities that got to roots of problems rather than just chasing incidents and chasing crimes, reached critical mass. And it's an explanation in no small part for the dramatic decreases in crime generally, but most specifically in our disadvantaged neighborhoods. Having said that, I was a state official in 2003 when the funding formulas were dramatically changed from the Department of Justice to the Department of Homeland Security. Mm-hmm. The federal government decided to not fight terrorism with a tax increase. And so what did they do? They took all the money out of the Justice Department for community-based policing training and sent it to Homeland Security to buy things. All right? Now, at that point in time when I was Secretary of Public Safety, I, in addition to being responsible for the Department of Correction and the State Police and the National Guard and Emergency Management, we had to distribute the grants. And it was infuriating to me as a career police chief. And I went down to Washington and I argued with these retired admirals and generals who, of course, knew. I mean, I'd been at the Pentagon. Policing had responded to 9/11. We already knew how to do first response. Our position was the best anti-terror weapon was community-based policing because officers ingrained in neighborhoods learn things from people who trust them. And every new and emerging ethnic group initially comes over here afraid of the police because of their experience in another country. All right. So if we're getting people from the Middle East or the Balkans, they need to develop relationships of trust with the people, with the police, because they're going to be victimized by their own people. That's the immigrant experience. So we could learn things and be first preventers. Okay. It's one thing to help us get to scenes quickly and save people. But, you know, that's not what we were offered. All right. The industry, if you will, police profession was told you can apply for a grant and you'll get this. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you had a bond investment in command vehicle building, I'm sure your stock went up and we could have taken all those command vehicles and circled them around some cities. All right. But we weren't investing in the kind of community policing we needed. Now, I mean, many police jurisdictions continue their community-based policing efforts. Don't get me wrong, but the widespread amounts of money that were available for training and experimentation, and you know, the best part about the grants is you experimented with different approaches, and then it could be replicated widely if it was seen to work somewhere. That disappeared. And it got to a point where I was widely quoted accurately as saying, Homeland Security became the monster that ate criminal justice. Hmm. All right. So when you see the outcome of this in terms of what the police have at their disposal, too many departments, I think, the go-to place is the toys they have rather than the community policing that they did. And I think what we're seeing is an optical reminder of that. But this initiative did not come from local police. All right. Yeah. They didn't decide we all needed, you know, anti-terror tools. That was a decision made by the federal government. And, you know, even to this day, community policing is funding is infinitesimal.
So were you offered all of those here in Milwaukee? Do we have those here?
Well, it took that was all going on while I was still in Massachusetts. Milwaukee really only made one investment that I can see in kind of heavy equipment. They got a command vehicle. All right. That can be used for a lot of things. And they got something called a Bearcat, which has a real good use, particularly, again, in hostage situations or wounded individual situations, because it can drive up, get them into it, and drive away. It's not a battering ram. It's not a tank. It doesn't have any weapons attached to it. That's about it. And they may have been able to get some, you know, gas masks and some other things, because there was a, you know, I was in D.C. when we had the anthrax scare. You know, I mean, within 1 year, we had 9/11. The anthrax square and the belt that scare, and then the beltway sniper. Mm. So we had a crazy time there trying to prepare for, you know, tactical attacks on the societal infrastructure. So, you know, trying to prepare for that stuff was not unwise, but the balance was out of whack in terms of funding formulas.
Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn is our guest this hour. More phone calls momentarily. The number is 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls for the Chief, Tom in Madison. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen and Chief Flynn. As a little kid, I grew up in Oconomowoc next door to your... one of your predecessors, Howard Johnson, and eventually I moved west toward Madison, and I kind of had the impression that Milwaukee police are more cowboys than communitarians, and I'm just calling to say that I find you articulate and intelligent and thoughtful, and I really encourage you toward the community policing model, and thanks for being on the air. That's it.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. Nice praise. And you're an educated guy.
Yes, but, you know, in praise is valued. It tends to be rare, so I'm very grateful for it.
Yes, I'm sure. We have a question. This concerns what happened yesterday about putting more police on the streets, a bit of a political controversy we'll hear more of as a mayoral race heats up eventually. What do you mean by changing the narrative of gun violence in Milwaukee from yesterday's press release? This is from our news department. He says it's a question of too many young men with illegal guns using them to settle disputes. How do we change that? It's a big one.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's a real challenge for us, and there's a number of components of it that I've addressed many times. You know, the majority of our homicidal violence is gun-related. We had 500 non-fatal shootings last year, plus 100 homicides. And, you know, 80% of our shooting victims and 80% of our homicide victims are African Americans, and the vast majority of them are young men somewhere in the ages of between 19 and 26. It's the number one cause of death. Nothing else comes close. Vast majority of those homicides are between people with criminal records settling disputes. So far this year, 100% of our homicide suspects have had criminal records. And so far, 100% of our homicide victims have had criminal records this year. So it's a narrow slice of the community, which is people with criminal records, heavily armed, highly motivated to shoot each other. Now, we can interdict that. We make high-quality arrests. We have already, as was fact-checked in the journal Sentinel, we've already seized from the streets of this city nearly as many firearms as New York City. We've seized over 1,400 guns from bad guys. I think New York City's up to 1,500. They have 8.5 million people. We have 600,000. Mm-hmm. Gives you some nature of what we're up against here and the activities we're engaged in. But we are also hampered, and this is good to be on FM radio, because when I say AM radio, everybody gets hysterical on me. But we are also hampered by the gun laws of Wisconsin. They're dreadful, okay? This is the fourth state I've worked in. They're crazy. We've got a circumstance where if you're arrested a second time for simple possession of marijuana, it's a felony. You can be arrested 10 times for illegal possession of a firearm, and it's never more than a misdemeanor. Now, if you're a career criminal, and you're worried about getting shot by another career criminal, and you're worried about getting locked up for a misdemeanor, or you're worried about getting shot, what's your rational move? You're going to carry the gun. All right, there's no disincentive to carry that gun right now. Now, I've been trying to bring this to the attention of the state legislature ever since they passed this goofy law. If you're going to pass a law that says you got to have a permit to carry a gun, then make it significantly illegal not to not have that permit. So that's strike one. Strike two is the legislature, in its infinite wisdom, has fashioned a law that arms legally criminals, career criminals. Okay? They only prevent convicted felons from having a firearm. Well, as you know, and as any thoughtful person knows, in busy urban jurisdictions, a lot of people plead guilty to significant misdemeanors instead of the felony because we can't have 30,000 trials a year. All right? So if you've been arrested six or eight times for drug dealing, maybe a couple of robberies that you ended up pleading out to, larceny, a couple of aggravated assaults where you pled out to simple assault, you want your gun permit, you've got it. Now, of course, the law is thoughtfully written. I'm not allowed to keep data on how many career criminals I arrest with CCW permits, but I can tell you anecdotally, we arrest a fair number, okay? The guy in the car with the drugs and the gun is the guy with the permit. The other three guys are felons. People are having their drugs guarded by guys with legal permits. Mm-hmm. Guys with legal permits are shooting other criminals. Now, by then, we've got him for a felony. Hooray. Mm-hmm. But we didn't prevent the shooting. So I'd like some help on the law side. I'm perfectly happy to give up sentences for simple possession. Yeah, that's dumb. All right? I don't need simple possession knuckleheads in prison. But I need to have a disincentive to carry that gun. Because if you leave the gun home, when you get in that chest bump at the college party, you don't pull out, both of you pull out your guns and shoot each other. All right. That's what we're up against. Yeah, we can keep making arrests, but we need some help on the legislative side, too.
Dave in Oshkosh. Hi.
Hi. I just had a question for your guest here. I've thought for a long time that instead of having these internal investigations, when there's an episode of police misconduct or, a homicide or a police shooting, that instead of having an internal investigation, every county should have a board of a review board of independent people, lawyers, judges, officers, just educated people in the community to review these cases independently. These internal investigations leave us with very little but questions at the end of it.
Thank you, Dave. Chief?
Well, as you may know, the law has recently been changed to require that an outside agency investigate any police use of deadly force, and we had one 3 months ago, and that's being investigated by the Department of Criminal Investigation of the state DOJ. So, there's no more thoroughly investigated act in government than a police use of deadly force. And even though police have historically investigated the uses of deadly force themselves, all of those investigations have always been subject to review by the DA, by the judiciary, by the federal government, as well as by the state. But now it's mandated. So that's where it is. And As it happens, the rest of the county is going to use the Milwaukee Police Department to investigate their shootings, and the Milwaukee Police Department is using the Department of Criminal Justice.
Without talking specifically about that shooting, there was Dontre Hamilton, and there was a gathering of people, his father included, at Red Arrow Park where the shooting took place. You, in a newspaper article after that shooting, were talking about, and this astounded me, 9,600 calls came to the Milwaukee Police Department about individuals who are in mental health crisis, 26 calls a day, and the pace has increased since that time. And yet the article went on to talk about the number of police officers who have received crisis intervention training having to do with mental health issues. Is that something you'd like to have more resources put toward, Chief Flynn? Is this a real problem area with the police force?
Well, it absolutely is. I mean, stop and think for a minute. I mean, the police are the social agency of first resort for everything.
Yeah.
And as society has generally disinvested in the social safety network, it's deferred everything to the criminal justice system. And when I was the Secretary of Public Safety and DOC reported to me, I was astounded to find out it was the biggest mental health facility in the state, was the Department of Correction. Okay? So it seems like there's no social problem for which the solution isn't more training for the police. And mental health is a real issue for us. Yeah, we do 8,000 to 9,000 calls a year. We do 5,000 referrals a year for services. And frequently, these folks are no harm to anybody but themselves. Frequently, for no fault of their own, they're violent and threats to other people. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they suddenly erupt. It's an unfortunate circumstance. Now, we've increased the numbers of CIT-trained officers, but that's a 40-hour course, and we've got 1,800 people to train. So although we've got 400 people trained, what we're doing is doing shorter versions of the course for more people. Everybody gets some of it in the police academy, but it's a real challenge for society, and I challenge the rest of society. Is the criminal justice system the ideal response to problems of mental health? Because if you didn't know better, you'd assume so. It's the police that are responding to the homeless problem. It's the police that are responding to the domestic violence family breakdown problem. It's the police who deal with the substance abuse problem and its effects on the community. We just want to say, you know, society needs to start funding better all the other resources that are supposed to be out there, all the other institutions and agencies that exist but are chronically underfunded. Because in our spare time, we're also fighting crime, fear, and disorder, even as we recognize the importance of handling mental health issues sensitively and thoughtfully. We can't always prevent them erupting into violence.
One more call. We have a minute left. Carl in Madison. Hi.
Yes, hello, and hello to your guest, Chief Flynn. I think some of the points that you've raised around where we put our money, what we bet on, you know, do we bet on the militarization of the police, the arming up against the quote-unquote bad guy, that tends to just breed the fears that are right down at the base reptilian, you know, part of our brain, where knee-jerk reactions and not careful, thoughtful dialogue tend to rule. And then the other side of it is, if you live in Dane County and you're African American, these are Dr. Pam Obler's statistics, sociology professor here at UW, you're 60 times more likely to do jail time if you're arrested for your first drug crime. So if that's the case, that if you're 60 times more likely than if you're white to do jail time, well, we all know what happens once you have something on your record. Where are these young men's opportunities?
And I need to end with that question. We have about 20 seconds, Chief.
Well, I think, you know, obviously we have to look, I think, in a broader way at drug prosecutions. I think we've certainly changed our policies here. Our number of simple possession arrests have declined every year since I've been here, because we recognize that if we're not careful with our tactics, we'll inadvertently lock people up while we're investigating something else. The big challenge for us is the extraordinary disparity in crime victimization in this city. I mean, if you're African American in this city, you're probably 5 or 6 more times likely to experience a crime than anybody else. And that's devastating to the community as well as to the lives of individuals, and we're all called upon to do something about that.
Chief Flynn, thank you very much. It's been a first interview with you. Please return. It was a valuable hour.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Thank you. Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn with us this hour. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the hour, and to KP as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We have news coming up from National Public Radio. In the second hour of the show, we will talk about the great Michelangelo. We really go from subject to subject, don't we? So joined us for that, Miles Unger, who's written a terrific book about six of the genius's masterpieces. All of that is coming up.